This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Warning, speed bump. The deep freeze holding thousand-year-old carbon is thawing faster. The Arctic tosses gigatons of CO2 and methane into the atmosphere, but that hasn't been counted so far. The newest permafrost science with Christina Schadl, senior research scientist at the Woodwell Climate Research Center in Massachusetts. Strangely, the third worst warming gas may become less serious as the world heats up. Atmospheric scientist Michael Prather with sort of good news on nitrous oxide. Satellites reveal global algae is expanding in new places. Is that good or bad? We asked Dr. Brian Barnes from the University of South Florida about the latest science. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. You got three interviews, no time to waste. Let's go. To stay below a dangerous 2 degrees hotter climate, or at least to have half a chance at it, we can't emit much more greenhouse gas. Here's just one big reason why. Previous estimates did not count growing carbon dioxide and methane leaking out of the Arctic. The deep freeze, holding thousands of years of carbon up there, is thawing. Permafrost has several pathways into the sky. Extreme northern wildfires in recent years made it worse. Christina Schadl is lead author of the new paper published January 24, 2026. She was trained as a biogeochemist and plant ecophysiologist at the University of Basel. Christina is now senior research scientist at Woodwell Climate Research Center in Falmouth, Massachusetts. Christina Schadl, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
So, as an introduction, how much carbon is locked up in the frozen north, and how much of that is leaking out into the atmosphere?
There's a lot of carbon in permafrost right now, and I find it helpful to think of it as permafrost contains about twice as much carbon as is currently contained in the atmosphere. The atmosphere has about 800 to 850 gigatons of carbon currently, and even that number doesn't mean that much to people. So I think the best really is to say the number is really big, and what is more important is that we have about twice as much carbon as in the atmosphere in permafrost right now. And we estimate that to be about 1,400 to 1,600 petagrams of carbon that are stored in permafrost. And there are some less well-quantified carbon pools in really deep sediments and subsea permafrost that would increase that number even more, but they are poorly quantified, so they are not included in this estimate. And given how big this carbon pool in permafrost is right now, even if only a very small portion of that is being released to the atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide and methane, it will really add a substantial amount of carbon to the atmosphere just because the pool itself is so big.
So let's figure this out. In past ages, there was a warmer world. There was almost tropical life right up to the Arctic Sea. And then the plant life somehow froze, and now it's coming back into the air as a greenhouse gas. Talk us through that long process at work here. How did it happen?
Yes. Permafrost is, by definition, frozen ground that stays frozen for at least two consecutive years. But most areas of permafrost are actually frozen for thousands of years. So that definition is a little misleading if it just says 2 years. And permafrost contains soil, rock, organic matter, and ice. And because it is frozen ground, it acts like a giant freezer. Things don't rot or decompose while they're in the frozen state or at a very, very slow pace. And the unique feature about permafrost is that it contains so much organic material, meaning it's dead biomass of partially decomposed plants and animal inputs that got frozen into the ground thousands of years ago. And some of that organic material is really, really old. As I said, thousands of years old. And as long as permafrost stays frozen, it's relatively inert, and only the upper layer close to the surface will thaw during the summer months and then refreeze again. We call that active layer because it's active during the growing season, but it's not the actual permafrost. And then temperatures in the Arctic are warming about four times as fast as the rest of the world, And that means that the ground doesn't stay frozen as much anymore. And we have observations that clearly show that permafrost temperatures have strongly increased across the entire Arctic by multiple degrees. And in many places, that means that the soil is thawing, so it's changing from frozen to unfrozen. One can think of this like food that was stored in your freezer, and when you take it out, and even if you put it in your fridge, it will start to thaw and decompose slowly. And the same thing happens with the organic material that's frozen in permafrost. Once it is no longer frozen all year round, it starts to thaw, and the microbes wake up and start decomposing that organic material. And with that process, they release carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere.
In 2019, permafrost expert Merit Turetsky told us large climate models that were used to advise governments did not include carbon dioxide and methane coming from thawing Arctic lands. Is this important source of carbon included now in newer models like CMIP-6?
The answer is complicated, but partially yes. There has been improvement in CMIP-6 models compared to previous versions, but those models that are included in IPCC assessment reports, in the 6th assessment report, only 2 out of the 11 models that were included for climate projections included a representation of permafrost carbon. So that's a relatively small number or a small percentage of the models. And then both of these models have the same land component, so there was very little diversity in how permafrost carbon processes were represented. And neither of these models included complex disturbance processes such as abrupt thaw or wildfire interactions. So far, models only include the gradual top-down thawing. And the next coupled model intercomparison project, CMIP-7, is underway. And some things will be improved, but disturbance processes will still not be part of those model runs.
Yes, those unusual processes. Merit told us about that. I mean, we expect Arctic thaw to be a slow process, taking at least hundreds and likely thousands of years. But some patches of permafrost thaw quickly, and we need to recognize emissions from abrupt thaw. What are your thoughts on the timescale of emissions?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And the important thing here is also to recognize that because it is a slow process, and the slow part does refer to the gradual top-down thawing mostly, it takes a while to get going, but then also once it has started, it doesn't immediately stop either. Again, once temperatures don't increase much anymore, it will not mean that permafrost thawing and carbon release stops right away because it is that slow process. And another important thing to note is that any of the carbon that has been released from or will be released from permafrost to the atmosphere, it will not come back into the soil anytime soon. So it's a largely irreversible process. And then in regard to abrupt thaw, the important thing here is that we are already seeing some of these abrupt thaw features currently. They were expected to happen, but further out in the future, and now they're already happening now. And in some areas, the ground doesn't fully refreeze anymore during the winter, which then means microbial decomposition continues throughout the winter, and that adds even more emissions to the atmosphere. Yeah, these abrupt processes are real. They're happening right now, and we anticipate large emissions from these abrupt processes.
Well, do you think emissions from permafrost thaw overall is right now or soon will be significant? Is there an urgency to this?
Yeah, there's absolutely an urgency to reduce warming, and not just for permafrost thaw. There are many, many aspects of climate change that really require high urgency for action. It's important to note that permafrost emissions do not dwarf anthropogenic emissions, meaning they're not larger than all anthropogenic emissions together, but they are similar in size to the emissions of a large industrialized nation. And how big they are does depend on the emissions pathways that we are headed towards the end of 2100. Right now, these emissions from permafrost are not accounted for in carbon budget calculations. So we are not actually accounting for all of the sources of emissions. And you can think of this like planning a meal without really understanding all the ingredients. You will end up with a meal that does not taste quite right because you did not include all the ingredients that are needed to be included. But unlike for a meal, missing a temperature target has big global consequences that are felt for decades.
Can we measure permafrost emissions in real time, say by satellites or a mass network of robotic sensors?
That's a very tough challenge because the Arctic is so vast and cold and very remote, so it's hard to measure permafrost emissions in many locations throughout the year consecutively. And then costs and logistics for anything like that are immense, and so that does not exist. There are efforts underway to provide at least annual updates of carbon emissions from permafrost, and these numbers will be coming from multiple but not that many locations across the Arctic. And even for those emissions, it takes a little bit of time to process the data. So you're not getting emission data from one day to the next day, but hopefully we can get emission data soon per year. And the challenge there is it involves many different groups from many different institutions and countries. They all have different data sharing policies. There's a lot of QA, a lot of quality control of the data that is needed. And so it's just, there will always be a little bit of a lag.
As you said, the Arctic is warming four times faster than the global average. So plants will benefit. Some will move north, capturing more carbon. Could added plant growth offset extra carbon leaking from the permafrost?
Yes, to some extent, that is possible. We know that plants benefit from warmer temperatures, and we know that they can grow bigger and further north if the conditions are right. But warmer temperatures are not the only thing that plants need to grow. They also need nutrients and water, and plants take some time to grow as well. They don't just grow much bigger within 2 years or move north within 2 years. That takes multiple years, and the change right now is happening so strongly. In many areas in the Arctic, we do see greening, so that means enhanced plant growth, but we also see areas where plants die, and that's called browning. That can be because of disturbance processes or droughts in the Arctic or other causes. And so the assumption is that plants will offset some of the carbon that is being released through increased decomposition, but overall the increased respiration, the decomposition part will be larger, especially because the cold season is getting shorter and warmer, and so there will be more carbon release throughout the cold season.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Christina Schadl, tell us about connections between wildfires and permafrost emissions.
Yeah, so obviously wildfires burn above ground biomass. We can see that with our own eyes when we see that a tree has burned. But the other part, the connection to permafrost, is also that wildfires can burn the highly organic surface layer that protects the layers underneath. And so that organic layer acts as an insulator. And when it is gone, much, much warmer air temperature can directly penetrate deep into the ground, thawing more soil that will lead to more carbon release. These deeper layers may be better protected from warming because it takes a while for them to warm up. But if that insulation is gone, the suddenly warm air temperature can suddenly get really into deep layers, and that's a connection between wildfire and permafrost thawing that hasn't been accounted for in models so far.
So we have at least three factors adding greenhouse gases in the far north. There is gradual thaw, abrupt thaw, and wildfire changes. How do these measure up in terms of emissions, and do they interact like feedback loops?
Yes, they do interact. The gradual thaw is a slow, steady release that as soils warm over time. Abrupt thaw affects smaller areas, but it releases carbon much faster and often with more methane involved. So it packs a higher warming impact early on. And then wildfires release a lot of CO2 right away, but they do take away that insulation of the soil, which warms the ground and then further accelerates gradual and particularly abrupt thaw afterwards. So all the processes are linked together, and fire makes thaw worse and increases carbon emissions earlier.
What happens when we add abrupt thaw and wildfire changes to those previous estimates that were used by most institutions of just the slow thaw?
When we include abrupt and wildfire emissions to the gradual thaw emissions, we increase the total emissions from the permafrost region by 170 to 260% compared to just gradual emissions alone. So it's important to also account for these emissions. Otherwise, we are ignoring a massive contribution of carbon dioxide or methane to the atmosphere.
For a realistic plan to keep warming below 2 degrees C, experts calculate the amount of carbon we could still release. Now, how do these previously unaccounted permafrost emissions change the budget for a 50% chance of staying below 2 degrees C?
Yeah, accounting for permafrost emissions really shrinks the remaining carbon budget by about 17% to avoid a 2-degree climate target. So that's about 1/6 of the remaining carbon budget that goes directly towards permafrost emissions. And so it's taken away from what human emissions can be.
It seems human aspirations, at least officially, go up to 2100 and stop. Is permafrost thaw an unstoppable process like some glaciers melting? How long could permafrost thaw continue to add more warming to the atmosphere?
Permafrost emissions will go on for a very long time and continue for hundreds of years. We do have model simulations that go way beyond 2100, but it is often hard to communicate the urgency of something if the year we are using is way beyond our current human lifetime. Like, no, none of us right now will still be alive at 2300. So it's really hard to communicate the urgency if we're talking about a time point that's far in the future. But we do expect permafrost emissions to continue for a very long time.
In 2020, another of your co-authors, Susan Natale, told us permafrost doesn't just add greenhouse gases in the Arctic summer. Winter emissions are real and increasing, and you mentioned that. Did your new team's modeling include this?
Yeah, it's important to know that the model that we are used for this study is a reduced complexity Earth system model, which means it doesn't simulate seasonal or monthly changes. We only get annual values, and they include the temperature, respiration process throughout the whole year. And emissions are therefore directly modeled by temperature. And that means winter emissions are sort of included, but not directly distinguishable from growing season emissions. That's why this model runs much, much faster.
Well, this sounds like a lot of new carbon from the far north, some of it highly warming methane. Do we know how much warming to expect from the permafrost source alone?
Yeah, global warming is directly proportional to cumulative carbon emissions. It's quite the linear relationship. And the challenge is to get a direct number from warming because it depends on the warming trajectories and the ratio of CO2 and methane, and those are things that are not entirely solved yet. But right now, we expect about 0.05 to 0.23 degrees Celsius warming just from permafrost by 2100. And because every tenth of a degree matters, it's important to note here again that this warming is in addition to fossil and land use emissions that are caused by warming.
Your new paper shows models and estimates for permafrost thaw seriously underestimate the emissions we're really putting up there, and this changes the promises made to avoid 2 degrees of warming and lowers the amount of carbon left supposedly to burn. But I've got to be frank, after 30 COP climate conferences and emissions are still growing, the process has kind of failed. How would you interpret this paper's results and language to communicate your findings to climate activists, the public, to our listeners? What is your message here?
That's a great question, and it is a challenge we face daily. I do want to say that there is no such thing, really, as how much carbon can we safely burn. These temperature goals under the Paris Agreement, 1.5 and 2 degrees, they don't really have a physical meaning, but they are useful for setting targets, and that's what you need for setting emissions goals in the policy landscape. So the best is to keep warming to the lowest number possible. And if we surpass 1.5 degrees, which we most likely will, the next next best target would be 1.6 degrees warming or even less. It's not 2 degrees Celsius. That's still way too far. And there's not a magic threshold that changes everything, but it's a policy-relevant goal. And the message from this paper is that warming-driven emissions, which is what permafrost emissions are, as well as wildfire emissions, they eat into that remaining carbon budget and reduce how much we have left. That means the remaining human emissions to stay below 1.5 or 2 degrees are much smaller than we have previously estimated. And in other words, permafrost and wildfire emissions don't change the temperature goal. They change how fast we must cut emissions to reach them. And that's a strong message, but a tough one to deal with because it requires even stricter emission reductions.
In my opinion, a possible methane seeping from the Arctic seabed gets more attention than actual greenhouse gases escaping right now from the permafrost. Why isn't this getting enough attention? Is there a save the permafrost or maybe watch out for the permafrost kind of activism?
I have also noticed that there is more attention for massive methane release from the Arctic. And my thinking is that it is a story that's easy to sell and that grabs attention. But what we are really concerned about are the continuous emissions from permafrost that will not stop very quickly. And I think the best safe to permafrost activism is to reduce global emissions.
What is the permafrost carbon network?
The permafrost carbon network is an international research network that coordinates and synthesizes data and knowledge on permafrost carbon, mostly on how much carbon is there, what are the mechanisms for releasing carbon as methane or carbon dioxide. And it's a very interdisciplinary community of permafrost and carbon cycle scientists. It includes people that take measurements in the field. It also includes modeling teams. And the focus really has been on quantifying the permafrost carbon feedback to climate change.
Christina, your degrees are from the University of Basel and your early work is in plant physiology. What drew you into a study of permafrost and climate change in the Arctic?
It's been a while now that I started working on permafrost, and I got the opportunity to do a postdoc that focused on permafrost and coordinating the permafrost carbon network. And when I started that position, I knew very little about permafrost, even though I had been to Alaska before. And once I started working on the topic, I realized how important it is in the global context and how much we don't know. And now, about 15 years later, I would say we know a lot more. And mostly the message is that we must act faster to reduce the impacts on the Arctic. And I want to give a shout out to all of my fabulous colleagues who have really helped shape the permafrost carbon network and bring in a lot of resources and enthusiasm to advance the knowledge.
From the Woodwell Climate Research Center, we've been speaking with Dr. Christina Schadl. She is lead author of the new study, Permafrost and Wildfire Carbon Emissions Indicate Need for Additional Action to Keep Paris Agreement Temperature Goals Within Reach. Find links to follow up in my show blog Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Christina, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You know about carbon dioxide and methane heating up the planet. Can you name the number three worst greenhouse gas? It is potent, long-lived, and a significant ozone killer. The global warming potential of nitrous oxide is nearly 300 times greater than carbon dioxide over 100 years. But for once, new science is not worse than we thought. Can you handle a little good news? When estimates for this gas were uncertain, scientist Michael Prather worked to nail down warming from nitrous oxide. Dr. Prather is professor of Earth System Science at University of California, Irvine. He specializes in atmospheric chemistry and published over 200 peer-reviewed papers and articles. From Irvine, California, Michael Prather, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Pleased to join you, Alex.
We can't see this gas, and strangely, inhaling it makes us laugh. What is nitrous dioxide? Sorry, what is nitrous oxide?
Nitrous oxide, yes. Nitrous oxide is an interesting, fairly inert compound, and inert compounds seem safe because they're not directly poisonous, although if you inhale too much nitrous oxide, you'll become asphyxiated and dead. But basically, those compounds tend to be long-lived. They accumulate in the atmosphere. You don't need to emit too much of it. You don't need to have too much leakage, and it starts lasting. And typically, if you throw a molecule in the atmosphere, it lasts about 100 years.
According to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, how important is nitrous oxide to heating up the planet?
Well, nitrous oxide is the number three. Originally, it was chlorofluorocarbons that were number three, but we've started eliminating emissions of those. So in terms of emissions, the nitrous oxide really is sort of like the number three component, sitting below methane and then sitting below carbon dioxide. The global warming potential is 300 times larger, which sounds huge, but of course we really only emit about 1% or less of nitrous oxide compared to the amount of CO2 we emit. So you have to scale those GWP numbers by sort of the scale of the industry.
And how do we put this up, we humans? How do we get the nitrous oxide into the atmosphere?
Well, once you make it, it's hard not to get it. Now, there are a few bugs that eat it if it's in the soil, but not many. It's not that, shall we say, delightful to eat or easy to eat, unlike some other compounds. Methane's much easier, for example, for the bugs to eat in the soil. But nitrous oxide, once you make it, tends to sort of bubble to the surface and get out. We make it primarily, we used to make it industrially through processes involving nitrogen, like making nitric acid, adipic acid, or industrial compounds. But right now, it's mostly agricultural. We fix nitrogen to make fertilizer, huge amounts of nitrogen, and then we put it on our fields, and then when the nitrogen is being decomposed in the soil, some of that decomposition goes into the plants for growth, which is why we fertilize them, but some of it forms nitrous oxide, then bubbles out. So right now, probably the biggest sources, the most growing sources, are agricultural-related, between fertilizer and agricultural waste handling from large cattle feedlots and other related things also will be a source of nitrous oxide.
So we track the amount of carbon dioxide in the air daily at Mauna Loa Observatory, and the second biggest warming gas, methane, gets a lot of press and a lot of groups studying it. Why do you think, Michael, that nitrous oxide has been kind of neglected and less known to the public?
Interesting question. I don't know why. I mean, sort of like, why do the forces of science decide to focus on one thing and not another? Sometimes it's logical, sometimes it's availability. The reason why methane is really hot now is there's so many different ways that you can measure it from space remotely. You see methane sources sort of bubbling out of regions, with satellites now. And nitrous oxide, we don't really have that capability, and I'm not sure we will. It's a much tougher gas to measure than methane. And so there's a lot of interest in methane, and it is, again, more important than N2O on an overall greenhouse effect. But the methane is also of interest because it's short-lived, and if we can tamp it down, it will disappear in a decade or two. Whereas nitrous oxide, we're there for years, like the chlorofluorocarbons. It's a long-lived compound. Once we emit it, we can't really get it back.
A key factor in warming potential of greenhouse gases is how long do they stay up there? Carbon dioxide lasts thousands of years, but methane's potential, as you say, it starts to decline after only about 10 years. In 2015, you led a paper suggesting a lifetime number for nitrous oxide. What did you find then, and what is the consensus in science before your latest paper?
Well, the 2015 paper was the one where we merged atmospheric measurements and about three different photochemical models of the atmosphere to try to understand what we think the lifetime is, derived from both the observations and derived from the models, sort of ab initio physics. And we found that, in general, it was pretty close. It was in 10-20%. And the models would calculate an N2O lifetime of maybe 130 years, and we're getting about 110 on the satellite data sets. So it was not so far off. And the patterns look good. The ability to model nitrous oxide to compare with the structures we see in the stratosphere is quite good. So I'd say that that's become sort of the gold standard in terms of lifetimes. And now it's really, most it's like about 115 years, 120 years are the numbers that are being used by the assessments.
In your later work, it seems to me you look at nitrous oxide persistence differently. Is it fair to say you now recommend a kind of sliding scale for nitrous oxide lifetime?
Sliding scale is always an interesting question. I think the nitrous oxide lifetime is changing. We always knew for a while back, long back, that there were feedbacks on it, but what we've seen recently is climate forcing of stratospheric circulation. The climate, the warming climate has basically sort of sped up the stratosphere, goes to the lung, it can sort of turn over faster. That is good for us because it destroys more nitric acid than it used to, nitrous acid than it used to. And so what I've found recently by looking at the satellite data and is that it's actually decreasing. So our lifetime is decreasing, which means the loss is increasing faster than how much we put up there. So we're finding out that the lifetime is dropping about 2% per decade, and that doesn't seem like much, but if you add it up over the century, it significantly affects the projections. Now, the one thing that has not really been put into any of the assessments, and the more recent paper that's out this week was interesting because we finally compared it and showed that the models were predicting a more vigorous circulation, but they had not yet calculated what it did to N2O. We could see the effect on N2O for the last 20 years, and the climate model seemed to predict that with any reasonable climate change, this circulation in the stratosphere will increase again and again. So the decrease in lifetime, and hence the faster loss of N2O, appears to be a fairly solid result, and it will, my estimate is, that after work looking at the climate model for circulation, is that it will happen through the century.
We get reliable data on the amount of nitrous oxide from something called the Microwave Limb Sounder Satellite. What is that?
So the Microwave Limb Sounder is a fascinating satellite. It looks in the microwave. So instead of having big telescope and lenses, it has microwave horns, like you think of. The wavelengths are out, it's centimeter long, very long wavelengths, and they measure the rotation of the molecule. And so a guy named Joe Waters at JPL sort of pioneered this work long ago. And it's an amazingly stable instrument. It's been running for over 20 years. No, very little degradation in general. And it's been delivering this wonderful, sort of constantly scanning the stratosphere for nitrous oxide. It also measures many other species, including ozone, temperature, as well as other interesting chemicals that we're interested in. It's about to die. And the instrument, the whole satellite platform has to die because it can't really be maintained in orbit and pointing in the right direction. So we've got maybe 1 or 2 years left. And right now there's no effort, there's no interest in doing a repeat of this, probably because this is sort of a matter of, NASA wants to do something that's new and interesting on science. They don't want to just keep monitoring it. And so the question would be, what needs to be done? Well, one of the things, solution would be you could wait 10 years and then put up an instrument, because this is a slow change over the century. So I don't really care if we monitor it every year. But we should eventually want to go back and look at nitrous oxide in the stratosphere probably another couple of decades, find out what's happening. And there may be other ways to check on stratospheric circulation.
Your latest paper is Projecting Nitrous Oxide Over the 21st Century, Uncertainty Related to Stratospheric Loss. That was just published in the top journal PNAS on February 2nd, 2026. To understand the problem, we need to grasp a kind of paradox. As the lower atmosphere warms, the upper layer, or stratosphere, gets colder. Why is that?
Well, that's because it's all, in this case, it's really CO2. But CO2 is an interesting molecule. It traps infrared radiation, and it emits radiation. So one of the things CO2 can do is it provides an antenna for the atmosphere to cool, if you want to think about it. It provides a way for the atmosphere to cool and radiate. But it also traps stuff. So in the lower atmosphere where we are in the troposphere, in the top of the troposphere, CO2 is capturing all the radiation leaving the Earth that we need to cool the planet. And it sends half of it back down and spends more out. Effectively, it sort of traps it and makes it much harder for the planet to cool. In the stratosphere, which is very, very thin, and is not much radiation is going through it, but it's hard to capture it there. What the CO2 does is it actually enables the atmosphere to cool, as it can radiate directly to space, which is very cold, about 3 degrees Kelvin. And so the stratosphere has been cooling for the last 20 years due to CO2, and the troposphere has been warming also due to CO2 and the other greenhouse gases. And so this creates a fairly large gradient between lower and above, and it's changing both the way waves propagate in the stratosphere and the way they change the circulation. And it's the combination of the two between a warmer troposphere and different storms in circulation down there changes the stratospheric circulation, which is what I was looking at, which appears that stratospheric circulation is turning over faster and faster. faster turnover means it pops nitrous oxide up higher and higher in the stratosphere where it gets destroyed faster.
Yes, you were dealing with something called the Brewer-Dobson circulation and its role in the availability of nitrous oxide as the world warms. What is that circulation and what's that got to do with how much gas is left up there?
Okay, so the Brewer-Dobson circulation stratosphere was identified by two scientists, Brewer and Dobson, looking at things. They actually had measurements in the lower stratosphere of things like helium, species like helium and water vapor, and they deduced looking at the distributions and the salty, they actually deduced that there was a circulation where the stratospheric air went up in the tropics and came down at high latitudes, mid latitudes. And this is called the Brewer-Dobson name for those two scientists from the 1930s and 40s. They also, in that sense, has been the core. What we've done since then, people who do stratospheric dynamical work, like doing the weather in the stratosphere, have done a lot of work on waves and propagation and understanding this. Actually, we see that the column of air from the troposphere, which is the source of N2O, bulk of it, gets sent up in the tropics and then splits out to the higher latitudes. In the tropics is where the most intense ultraviolet is, and so the faster and higher up you move it, the more rapidly it's destroyed. And so what we've been seeing lately is a speed up of the circulation overall, and the speed up of circulation means you're taking up gases like chlorofluorocarbons and nitrous oxide and even methane up to higher altitudes where they're more rapidly destroyed.
Excess nitrous oxide is doubly harmful in the atmosphere. Yes, it is a powerful warming gas, but nitrous oxide also leads to more destruction of the ozone layer that protects us from harmful radiation. The chemistry is pretty involved, but Michael Prather, can you help us understand why nitrous oxide damages ozone?
So nitrous oxide is one of the source gases of other chemical radicals that it leaves behind in the stratosphere. In the same way that the chlorofluorocarbons were the source gas for chlorine radicals, nitrous oxide, when it gets broken up by sunlight, releases NO, nitric oxide. And NO and NO circulates with ozone back and forth, the same way that chlorine atoms circulate with ozone back and forth to basically catalytically destroy it. So they run chemical cycles around anywhere from 25 to 50 kilometers in the stratosphere that chew up ozone more rapidly than would be natural. And so we've been worried, of course, about chlorofluorocarbon depletion because that releases chlorine atoms that do it. And we've always been also worried about the nitrous oxide. And so right now, our threat to stratospheric ozone is not CFCs because the Montreal Protocol has controlled those gases. But it's really right now, it's the N2O that we've done nothing to control at all. It appears to be very difficult to control it based upon empirical evidence. That is, what's happened to N2O in the real world and what we think we're doing to it. A bit of an optimism that we can reduce emissions on nitrous oxide. And I think the evidence has shown that we really can't.
Would that change your calculations? It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that you used a kind of fixed emission rate, maybe based on human-induced emissions right now, rather than trying to figure out what humans will do with emissions. Is that how you did approach it?
Well, for the projections, what I took was the IPCC has a group called, generates SSP, Shared Socioeconomic Pathways, emissions for future types of world. And the types include issues of technology, sharing governance, environmental issues, and so on. And they have a range of scenarios that are used for the climate assessment. And so these scenarios are the ones we'd also use for the ozone assessment. And they have a range of predictions depending upon what we think what we're doing for the N2O emissions. The emissions are then mapped onto a model, which in this case has a fixed lifetime, unlike the one that I just made, has a fixed lifetime, and then you project nitrous oxide into the future out to 2100 or so. If you look at what's really happening to nitrous oxide, it's been increasing regularly, and the increase is even getting faster every year. And so we've been accelerating the increase in the atmosphere. And what I did was take that increase and calculate what the flux would have to be. And then I took that flux and ran it through my model with a changing lifetime and showed what it does to our projections of nitrous oxide. So the goal is there are lots of people working on reducing nitrous oxide emissions, and almost all these scenarios have reductions in nitrous oxide because we want to get rid of it because of the climate gas. Now, problem is, if you look at what's happened and the historical record, it's always well above these projections. And so it's a very interesting game that there's an optimism that exists, and the people who build the scenarios, that there's a possibility of control. And just from what we've seen in the atmosphere, there appears to be yet no will or no ability to control the emissions.
In our previous interview in October 2024, you told us methane stays in the atmosphere longer than we thought, and that's kind of bad news. Now, this is better news for nitrous oxide. Why are you investigating these gases, and what still needs to be done?
That's interesting. You're right. So my main interest in the science I work on is understanding the lifetime, the sort of chemical cycles, the transport, and what really controls the sort of chemistry and whatever that it controls the lifetimes of these gases, because that controls their buildup. And so a lot of people work on emissions of them, where they're coming from, what's happening. And I tend to work on the atmosphere and the chemistry. And so when I started working on the methane one, I found out that there are more likely ways to reduce it. We might have a faster loss of methane, okay, which would be good, and that might work or not. But the N2O one, I found the opposite by looking at the observations of N2O. The methane one, we had to deal with the best chemistry we had, and I wasn't really paying too much attention to the observations of methane for a lifetime. But with N2O, we have enough measurements in the stratosphere, we can actually calculate the lifetime directly from the mix of abundances that are measured by the MLS satellite, for example.
From the University of California, we've been speaking with distinguished Professor Michael Prather. He is lead author of the new paper, Projecting Nitrous Oxide Over the 21st Century, Uncertainty Related to Stratospheric Loss, published in PNAS. Find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Michael, thank you for sharing this new science with us.
Thanks, Alex. Delighted to talk to you.
Covering the world. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Worried about climate tipping points? According to new science, the tipping points for macroalgae blooms occurred around 2010. What happens to seaweed and plankton as we heat up the ocean? Should we care? Our first big look at the state of world algae was published in Nature Communications in December 2025. The title kind of gives away the plot. Global floating algae blooms are expanding. Our guest, Dr. Brian Barnes, is a co-author and assistant research professor at the College of Marine Science, University of South Florida. From St. Petersburg, Brian Barnes, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Let's begin with the very basics. What is algae?
Algae is a pretty broad term that encompasses a whole lot of different life, including things that are as small as a single cell that can only be viewed under a microscope, and as large as something that can grow into something you can see with your hands, and even it makes huge ecosystems that impact our entire Earth. But broadly, they're similar to plants, but just on a different tree.
There's a difference between macroalgae, we can see it, and microalgae, which we can't. Is your study about one or the other of those?
It's about both.
Okay. And I note that the word seaweed includes so many plants. I mean, it's kelp, it's nori, it's dulse, wrack, spirulina, sea moss. There's so many. Which seaweed has been the focus around Florida?
Right. So all of those individual species that you listed are different types of algae. They're brown algae, they're red algae, and different categories within algae. In the state of Florida, what we're most interested in right now is sargassum, which is a type of brown macroalgae, and it floats at the surface of the water. And recently, as part of one of the blooms that we describe in this paper, it's the abundance, the footprint, the size, and the amount of sargassum that impacts the Atlantic Ocean and Florida specifically are increasing.
Well, there's been a big patch of sargassum in the Sargasso Sea. I mean, explorers found it. It seems to have escaped, though, because it invaded popular Mexican beaches in 2015, 2018, 2022, and 2025. It's a smelly mess. Is this connected to increases found in your paper?
Yes, and no, actually. So the story of sargassum in the Atlantic Ocean is kind of complex in the last couple of years. So you are correct that the first records we have of sargassum were from the original transatlantic travelers, Columbus and the like, who noted this habitat, this floating macroalgae in the middle of what he called the Sargasso Sea. It's named for the sargassum. So the sargassum there has been there for a long time. There are a lot of little critters that live in and amongst it. There are, you know, invertebrates, little shrimps and crabs and things that even use mimicry to look like the sargassum so that they can kind of blend in with this environment. So they're huge. They're called golden floating rainforest sometimes. They're just huge places of life and abundance in kind of what generally the open ocean is thought to not have a whole lot going on. Whether or not that's a fair characterization, it's true that sargassum mats would be where you would find an abundance of life in the ocean. So with that long history, we found that somewhere around 2011, we've noticed that there was a new footprint. Essentially, the sargassum from the Sargasso Sea stopped being just in the Sargasso Sea, and it instead started to form a new bloom, a new footprint, more in the tropical area. So instead of thinking between, you know, North America and Europe, this is between Central America and Africa. So a little bit farther south, and this bloom is the one that impacts the Mexican coast, all of the islands in the Caribbean, and Florida as well. And this bloom is really the one that's causing the tourism and other issues. And we have no recorded history of sargassum coming ashore in those areas, in these high abundances, in all of recorded history. So this is a new phenomenon for the Central Atlantic area. While this is happening, one other thing that we've noticed, and we just published a paper on this last month, is that Sargasso Sea sargassum, the one that had been there for 400 at least years, seems to have declined quite a bit. So while we've got this this major increase in sargassum in the tropical Atlantic, that original population, the Sargasso Sea sargassum, has declined somewhere around 90% over the last 10 years.
So longtime marine watchers thought we were seeing more seaweed in recent decades, but we really didn't know what is happening with macroalgae globally until this new paper?
Yeah, that's correct. We had hints of little pieces of this, a story of this here happening, and then, of course, there's been all of this news coverage on sargassum, the huge inundations and so forth that are part of the Great Atlantic Sargassum Belt. So we have little pieces of stories, but this study is the first one that really puts that all together, both with the macroalgae and the microalgae, to tell kind of a comprehensive story from what you can see from satellites.
The new paper on global algae is led by Dr. Lynn Key from the NOAA Center for Satellite Applications and Research. And for the layman, Brian Barnes, how did your team determine algae changes at the global level?
Right. So we have, we'll call them weather satellites, but essentially there are cameras that are passing, orbiting every day, looking down on the oceans, and they've been doing so for the last 25, 30 years, at least this one particular sensor that we've used here. So it's looking down on the oceans, collecting, we'll call them images, but it's got a lot more information than simple what you would collect with a camera. But from this, we can we've developed some artificial intelligence and machine learning approaches that kind of quickly read in that satellite information and detect very fast, very quickly, whether or not there is floating algae. And you do that over the million or so images that have been collected over the last 25 years, and you can start to build up this picture, not only of what's happening in space, but in time.
And where did you find the largest expansion of algae blooms? I mean, is it only in the Western Atlantic? Is it happening over in the Pacific?
Yes, it's happening somewhere over about 12% of the total global ocean surface area, and that includes the Atlantic. We've talked a little bit about that. It includes the Indian Ocean, some in the Pacific, including around Hawaii and then east of Australia, and pretty much throughout the oceans with the exception of the Southern Ocean and the Arctic Ocean. Those are the only two places where we really don't have any indication that there's these large changes.
What changed around 2010, and why call it a tipping point?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I don't necessarily have a satisfactory answer. It's not likely that there is a single event that caused, you know, both an increase in macroalgae in the South China Sea and similarly at the same time a new bloom forming of sargassum in the Atlantic Sea. There's just not really a lot of connection there. But likely the overall global picture is just becoming more suitable for these macroalgae blooms. So just like with any plant, an algae just needs the right things to grow. It needs the fertilizer, it needs a seed population, it needs the right temperature and light regime. And once you have those, then you will start to have a bloom. So essentially the conditions became right, and then the seed populations, be it an expansion of the sargassum footprint or something else causing some of these other, starting these other blooms, it just creates the conditions where the blooms can flourish.
And we've had many remarkable marine heat waves appearing in world oceans. Do we know how global warming, is it a significant factor in promoting these bigger floating algae blooms?
Yes and no. I'll speak mostly about sargassum because I work with that more than some of these other blooms. But as with anything, there's a temperature tolerance. There's a tolerance for where it will grow, and then there's a tolerance for what it can survive. You know, you may warm up to the point that you're now into a condition whereby you're having a longer potential growing season because the water is just warmer. But if you have too much of a heat wave, then you may end up tipping on the other side of that scale, into which you see declines in either the ability to grow or just in the ability to survive.
You mentioned that some of the research was done by satellite, and I can see how you could see the big floating mats, but how could you measure locations and amounts of microalgae, things that we can't see without a microscope, from the distance of space?
Yeah, so the microalgae that we look at, I'll characterize them into two different groups here. You know, there's an entire field of satellite oceanography called ocean color. And basically, that's looking at the ocean to see what color it is. And you can infer from the color. If the water is green, then there's chlorophyll in the water, very basically. So that is one way that we're able to tell about chlorophyll microscopic algae from 700 kilometers in the air. You can see the change in the color of the water. But for these types of features, we're actually looking at things that are floating on the surface. And there is one particular measurement that the satellite is recording that plants and algae and vegetation in general gives us a very bright signal in this, it's called a near-infrared band. So we can pick it up very strongly against the contrast of background water, where if you have none of this deep red light comes up from the ocean, but it reflects very strongly from microalgae. So a long way to say this, from the satellite perspective, we can pick up, even if an individual satellite picture has something like 0.2% coverage by a floating matter, we can pick it up from a satellite.
I've read that microalgae and macroalgae produce about 40% of the Earth's oxygen supply. So isn't more algae at sea a good thing?
Yeah, it can be. There's been a lot of research done on using the growth of algae, microalgae, macroalgae in the oceans, both to generate oxygen, but also to draw down CO2. So generally, yes, we think that generating oxygen, drawing down CO2 are both good things, especially in our changing climate. Yes, there has been a lot of evidence or a lot of research into plants, macroalgae, microalgae as producing oxygen and drawing down CO2. And there's been a lot of work to try and create conditions that would draw down CO2 by fertilizing the ocean with nutrients and so forth.
In the why should we worry department, I was startled to find out that big blooms of sea plants can dramatically change the whole climate of the Earth. Tell us about the Azolla event 49 million years ago.
Yeah, the Azolla event is actually a really interesting phenomenon that happened. So you have to, taking yourself back 49 million years ago, the world was a little bit different. The continents weren't exactly where they are now. But basically, the way they found this is they were doing some cores, they were digging into the mud, essentially, in the Arctic Ocean. And they found that there were some freshwater tropical plants there, essentially. And the remains of these plants lasted over 800,000 years. So there was a long time period where you had a tropical freshwater plant growing in the Arctic Ocean. And basically the thought is these plants, conditions just like we discussed, when you have the right conditions for plants to grow, they will grow, and as we also mentioned, when plants die, they can draw down carbon dioxide. So when they die, their skeletons fall, and they also take their CO2 that they've built up, their plant matter, with them. So the broad thought is that the conditions were right 49 million years ago, that this plant, this singular tropical freshwater plant, was able to grow, and it flourished for 800,000 years, and it drew down so much carbon dioxide because it was fed by the constant, the summertime sun always being above, it had plenty of nutrients and so forth. It drew down enough CO2 to essentially lead us into our current climate from where we were 400 parts per million above CO2 above where we are now. So it was a huge, or potentially a major driver for the climate that we live in today, was the existence of this plant.
Could today's expanding marine algae change the planet, and do we know in what ways? That's a huge question, but what are your thoughts?
I think absolutely it could. The problem is a matter of scale. So if you were to sink all of the macroalgae that's in the ocean today, we've reported how much is out there. If you sunk it all today, it wouldn't make a drop. It wouldn't matter at all in the context of the overall global carbon cycling. Now, if you did it over the time frame of 800,000 years, yes, it would matter. But in the shorter term, in the timescales that are relevant for what humans are doing to this changing climate, it doesn't matter at all.
Well, just to be clear, there's not just one algae operating in similar ways around the world. Different regions develop different dominant plants for different reasons. How do you pull a meaningful pattern out of that?
Yeah, I think the broad message that we're trying to show with this paper, noting that, we have green macroalgae, brown macroalgae, floating microalgae, all of these different species. The larger Earth system is, our argument is, the larger Earth system is becoming more favorable to growth of either, these large macroalgae or of microalgae that grow at the surface. So the surface waters are becoming more favorable for growth than, say, the interior of the ocean. Because we talk about the light regime and the nutrient regime and so forth, we also, as I mentioned, we measure the in-water chlorophyll, phytoplankton. Those are also algae. So we don't see any change in what's happening in the larger global ocean as far as how much phytoplankton and so forth is in there. But we do see the surface waters changing. So the larger story that kind of connects all of these different pieces together is that the surface ocean is apparently more favorable for growth around the world than it used to be.
From the University of South Florida College of Marine Science, we've been speaking with Dr. Brian Barnes about the new paper, Global Floating Algae Blooms Are Expanding. Find links and more information to follow up in my show blog, Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Brian, thank you for sharing with our listeners.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
We are out of time. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.